It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the inner workings of Congress with Paul Singer.
But first, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York just released a report indicating that household debt is on the increase. In fact, this would be the third consecutive quarterly increase.
As Americans dig themselves out of the aftermath of the Great Recession, they're apparently borrowing a little more, but not so keen to run up credit cards or commit to new mortgages.
To find out what this means for households and the economy, we have with us Amer Sufi. He's professor of finance at the University of Chicago School of Business and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. His new book is House of Debt, How They and You Caused the Great Recession and How We Can Prevent It from Happening Again. Amer, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, looking at this report, it gets a little confusing. Overall debt is up, but we consumers are a little reluctant. We're scaling back on our credit cards, things like new mortgages. I want to start with a big picture. When we're looking at household debt as an indicator, is a rise in debt good news or bad news?
Well, it can be either. It really depends on whether the rise in debt is driven by what we would call fundamental economic improvements, higher wages, higher income, higher earning power, basically. And if it's not, if debt is rising the most for people who actually don't have better income growth or better wage growth, then that's kind of not a great thing. That's not a very sustainable way of generating economic activity.
So we've seen this household debt go up a little bit for three quarters in a row. How do you read that? Is this a good increase in debt or a bad increase?
Well, it's driven mostly by two main factors, and that is student debt and auto debt. And in both circumstances, in my view, there are some worrying factors. For example, wage growth among college graduates continues to kind of be depressed, and the unemployment rate facing college graduates continues to be high. So it seems like people are optimistic going into school, willing to take on more debt, yet the actual wages they're going to earn, the wages they're going to need to earn in order to pay back that debt is still pretty, that wage growth is still pretty low. And so you do worry that student debt with this rising burden of it is going to continue to kind of depress economic activity among younger Americans. We're talking home buying, spending. That's the kind of worry I think a lot of people have when they're looking at this rising student debt number. On the auto side, what's interesting is a lot of the auto debt is also being driven by extension of credit to what I would call more marginal borrowers, people with low credit scores, subprime borrowers. In fact, subprime auto loan issuance has increased substantially. And again, I would point out, do we really think wage growth is actually improving among these low credit score, low income individuals? And if not, then again, we worry that eventually they won't be able to pay back this debt. And so it's kind of a short-term boost to economic activity, but it might not be viable in the long run.
So what we'd like to see for economic growth and recovery is people thinking, I've got a better job, I'm more confident that I'm going to keep my job in the future, therefore I'm willing to take out this loan for a car or a home or something. You're worried that with student loans and auto loans in particular, we're not seeing that. We're seeing people maybe being overextended.
That's right. I mean, I don't want to sound the fire alarm, but it does look to me like we are not yet seeing the kind of improvement in the job market, in wages, that would sustain higher levels of debt. The rise in debt over the last three quarters, as you mentioned, it has increased. Now, it hasn't increased substantially. And in fact, the pattern that worries me more is not so much the aggregate increase in household debt, but it is kind of when I look at the micro data and I look at the fact that, especially in the auto loan space, you do see a lot more subprime auto loan issuance. And so you worry, well, what's eventually going to happen when people might not be able to pay back that debt? That obviously means more defaults in that space, but it also means potentially we won't see as many new car sales, which are an important part driving economic growth currently.
Now, when subprime became a household word and maybe a dirty word, it had to do mostly with mortgages. What are we seeing there as far as people's willingness to take on mortgage debt?
That's what's interesting. And the mortgage market seems to be the one anomaly in current loan markets. Even credit card debt issuance, as you mentioned, it has gone down overall. But credit card originations, just people getting a new credit card, whether they're spending on it or not, has been going up for lower credit score individuals as well. So auto loans and credit card loans has been going up for subprime individuals, but mortgage debt continues to be a spot where there's extremely high credit scores among the people who actually are able to successfully get a mortgage. So it seems like lenders in some sense got burned so bad that they're not returning to that space. And so that space is basically still dead. There's basically almost no credit issuance to very low credit score individuals in the mortgage space. It seems instead that lenders have moved to the auto and credit card space in order to kind of extend credit to these low credit score individuals.
So that's coming from the banker's side in the mortgage. It's a matter of bankers saying, we don't want to make risky loans, not people maybe on the margins saying, I can't afford this mortgage right now.
Right. And that's one of the things our research shows pretty definitively and our book, and that is there is a substantial segment of the U.S. population that essentially will borrow if they're given the opportunity to borrow. And that's something that's a bit worrisome. So even if they don't have wage growth, even if they don't have income growth, oftentimes if a creditor is willing to extend them credit, even if they can't handle that increased debt burden, they sometimes will take it. So that's something that you do see right now in the subprime auto space and the credit card space, but I would agree, it's not, in my opinion, people not wanting to get a mortgage because they don't feel like they can actually sustain one. Instead, it seems more coming from the other side, that they're not able to get a mortgage. A lender's not willing to extend them that credit.
Going to the topic of your book and the big picture here, I think a lot of people are looking at all this and saying, it's fine as long as you don't go back to what happened in 2008. Have we as individuals, have lending institutions, the government for that matter, learned lessons from 2008 to where we're going to avoid that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see the kind of rapid increase in household debt that we saw from 2000 to 2007. To be frank, that was an unprecedented rise in household debt that you'd have to go all the way back to prior to the Great Depression to see that kind of rise in household debt. Although I will say one of the things that we're trying to push in this book is just the notion that debt itself is a very dangerous instrument, even if it's not used in a huge amount of quantity, because of the way it distributes the losses from an economic crash. And that is, the indebted, who tend to be poorer individuals, lower net worth individuals, they basically take the first hit when they have a lot of debt. And that's something that we argue we need to kind of rethink the financial system in order to get rid of such harsh debt contracts that impose these losses on the people who are least able to actually handle them.
So is the answer there making debt less accessible to people in that situation or making it more affordable and less risky?
It could be either. So, for example, there's been a big rise in people renting homes. Renting homes, in our view, is a good thing. It's basically saying to people, look, you might as well take whatever extra cash you have, maybe put it in assets like the stock market or bonds or even deposits in a bank. That, in some sense, is a less risky bet than sometimes putting it into a home with a mortgage, because the analysis we always give is, if you have a $100,000 home, if you have an $80,000 mortgage, so you have $20,000 of equity, if your home goes down $20,000, you take that loss. You lose 100% of your investment before the lender takes any loss at all. And that's the notion by which we mean debt is a very harsh instrument. And so we kind of advocate either people renting or having debt contracts that are more flexible. Suppose you have a debt contract where the principal balance actually went down if house prices fell in your neighborhood. Those are the kinds of ideas we basically talk about in the book.
As we wrap up for now, this is one indicator among many, this report from the Federal Reserve of New York. What do you have your eyes on? What are you watching for next?
Well, I definitely look a lot at what's going on among the more marginal borrower population. People who basically are still very much struggling in the aftermath of the Great Recession, still seeing very low wage growth. This is related, of course, to the increase in inequality that we've seen over the past couple of decades. And I'm watching this segment of the population to see, are they getting better wages? Are they better getting better income? Or are they fueling aggregate spending by just levering up again, getting an auto loan, getting a credit card loan? If it's the latter, if they're just getting more debt to fuel economic activity, then that kind of gives me a worried feeling about the future of the economy, that it might not be as robust as we might even think it is, even though most people think it's pretty weak already.
Amer, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Amer Soufi, professor of finance at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's the co-author of the new book, House of Debt. It's time for a weekly roundup of what's going on in Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Since the 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Republicans have been accusing the White House of covering things up. They've voted to set up a new panel to continue the investigation.
And Democrats may be at odds with the president. They're blocking one of his judicial nominees and have taken up a set of corporate tax breaks in the Senate that the president has threatened to veto. As always, there's a lot of news from the road to this fall's midterm elections, too, that we can look at. Paul Singer joins us every week at this time to share the goods from Washington. Happy Wednesday, Paul.
Happy Wednesday to you, Veronica. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Well, the House voted to create a panel to investigate the 2012 terrorist attack on the U.S. mission in Benghazi. Now, this is not the first probe into the events that happened. What exactly is the game plan here for Republicans in the House?
That is a very good question. And it is not clear they have a very good answer. In fact, the Democrats at this point have not said whether they're going to participate in this thing because they're not sure what the game plan is either. There's a bunch going on here. As you mentioned, there have already been several probes by other House committees run by Republicans into what happened September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi. It's a very complex picture, in part because ultimately this is an attack on a CIA annex to a diplomatic building, and the CIA doesn't want to talk about what they were doing there. So you're into a lot of sensitive information. And these probes have already been going on, and so now why do you launch a new one? It seems clear the Republicans don't want this just to be a rehash of old allegations that doesn't get anywhere. And it also seems sort of clear they would like to centralize this discussion so it's not going on five different places at once. What is not clear is whether they're going to try and, you know, subpoena former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, whether they're going to try and force testimony from current Secretary of State John Kerry, who, of course, was not Secretary of State at the time, whether they're going to focus on talking points that the White House was kicking around in the immediate aftermath of the attacks for how they would speak about it on television. That is the part that has been the most aggressive line of attack by Republicans the past few weeks, but it's the one that in some ways means the least, because it's really just about what did you say on TV, not about what did you do to protect Americans on the ground.
Right, so there's a lot that we don't know about how things are going to proceed. Do you have any sense of what they're looking for, per se, that they haven't been able to get at so far?
No. In fact, there was an interesting article a couple of days ago that we had where we had sort of probed into what they were looking for on the commission, and there was a quote from a Democrat who said, look, you know, all the there's no unanswered questions here. It's been pretty clear that, you know, what happened there. It's been pretty clear that it was a terrorist attack planned by an Al-Qaeda offshoot on a base that was a CIA mission, that there was a dispute between the State Department and the CIA over who's supposed to be protecting it. There's not a lot of unanswered questions. And the chairman of the committee, Trey Gowdy, responded that there's still unanswered questions about the talking points of what the administration said immediately thereafter, sort of immediately diverging back to this sort of conversation about was the administration trying to hide the fact this is a terrorist attack just before the elections of 2012. So I don't know. I mean, I honestly can't tell you exactly what questions they're going to pursue and whether there is terrain. Because keep in mind, if they conclude there's a lot of unanswered questions about the military response and about the security of this facility, they are concluding that their own investigations didn't answer the questions, which is also not a good thing for the Republicans.
Well, but then you've got Democrats who are saying that this is just being dragged out because it could be of some use to Republicans in the midterm elections and could possibly be damaging to Hillary Clinton, who's emerging as a strong candidate for 2016. How do you see it from where you stand?
Well, it is impossible to look at this without recognizing that there is a large Hillary Clinton element, that a significant portion of this is spawned from doubts that Republicans have about Hillary Clinton's veracity. And they see her as somebody who is fundamentally not telling the truth. And, of course, they care about her still, despite the fact she's no longer in office, because she could be a 2016 presidential candidate. I don't think that's an unfair allegation to make, that these guys are partly interested in this because it's a Hillary Clinton issue. But they also, I mean, I think in fairness to them, they remember a lot of Republicans don't believe that the Obama administration has been very forthright on a bunch of things, and they think this is an issue where they can prove the Obama administration has not been forthright, and it's a good issue to stick to for them because there's plenty of, you know, territory there to make this point that we don't trust Obama.
And real quick before we move on, because there's a lot to talk about, is there evidence that Americans, should Hillary Clinton come out, you know, looking less than idealist, that they're going to care, that voters are going to care about this, and it's enough to give her to take a hit in 2016?
You know, who knows? I mean, a presidential campaign is long. There are 1,000 hits between here and there. Who knows which ones stick? My impression is that Benghazi is a really good way to fire up the base. I am not convinced and have not seen polling or any evidence that it is a broad attack. It's the sort of thing that would broadly sour people on Hillary Clinton if they were otherwise inclined to vote for her.
Well, and yesterday, the Democratic-controlled Senate took up a set of tax breaks for businesses, tax breaks that would increase the deficit. Now, this, as you know, after a long time where Congress was sort of in alarm mode about anything that would raise the deficit. So yeah. What's going on here? Is the Senate just not that into lowering the deficit anymore? And are we into a new phase?
They're just not that into you anymore. Yeah. Well, you know, the deficit's getting smaller. The deficit has been shrinking. The economy has been getting a little bit better. And so, to some degree, the panic is off. The other thing is that, you know, it's I don't know that I've ever seen a temporary tax break. Once you create these temporary tax breaks, it's hard to have them go away. And what this bill would do is extend a whole bunch of existing tax breaks for everything from research and development to, you name it, the little tax breaks that's out there, you know, for small businesses and other things. And it's billions of dollars. I'm trying to remember what the number is, but it's a lot. It's like $150 billion over 10 years. And the administration has been very interesting on this point. What they've said is, we don't want to do this unless we can figure out some way to offset the revenue. Oh, and by the way, we think you should be extending the unemployment tax break or the unemployment insurance, and we have figured out ways to finesse the numbers on that thing. So maybe there's a point here where we can finesse some of the numbers on these things, and it won't really count as an offset, and it'll, now you get into the weeds of how Congress budgets for stuff. The administration has not said, we're going to veto this bill. But the administration, you know, wants to be clear that they don't want to just give away the store again for no reason. You know, my hunch is it's an election year. These are tax credits that already exist in law. It's hard to repeal them or let them die, particularly when you've got a bunch of moderate Democrats trying to win re-elections and Senate seats.
Okay, in our last minute here, we've got a story from West Virginia. West Virginia poised to make history. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, they got two women running for the Senate against each other, and they will have a woman senator. I think it's the first woman senator West Virginia will ever had, replacing Senator Rockefeller, who's been there for several decades, and the two candidates, Congresswoman Capito and Tennant, who is the Attorney General now, I believe. Two women will be facing off. It's not often we see a woman versus woman Senate race. But they're becoming more common in America as more women are getting involved in politics. And we will have a woman senator from West Virginia one way or the other. And that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, an interesting story there. Apparently, they're only the 13th state to have two women in for the upper office there.
Yeah, but you'll see that more of those races have been in the past few years. Like it was a long time before it ever happened, and in the past 5 or 6 years, you've seen several of them. So I think you'll see more of it. And we've written and on this show we've talked about the fact that, you know, women in the Senate are becoming a force, and in some cases a force for a more productive, more moderate Senate.
Looking at a trend. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us as always.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
That was Paul Singer, politics editor for USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time to share the week's news from Congress.
One of the biggest steps for people returning to their communities after prison is finding a job.
But getting that job can be a challenge. A prison record can scare off potential employers, and a lack of work experience in communities with few job opportunities can make it even harder.
Our next guests have been following this issue. One is a journalist, and the other is part of a Milwaukee effort to help former prison inmates make the transition back to their communities. Monica Potts is a senior editor at the American Prospect. Her recent piece, Is There Hope for Survivors of the Drug Wars, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Monica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, we have Wendell Ruschka. He's executive director of Project Return in Milwaukee. Wendell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Wendell, how important is employment for an ex-inmate trying to make that transition back to life in their community?
Well, it is really a key aspect for an individual to be successful with their reentry. To be able to have a purpose, to be able to have someplace to go every day, and to be able to sustain themselves and their families is something that is crucial for an individual to be able to feel that they have that ability. And too often people returning from incarceration don't believe that they have any worth or ability to get that employment. So all too often returning back to criminal lifestyles or criminal thinking patterns or addictions, which have gotten them in trouble in the past. So ability to find and keep gainful employment is a key aspect of keeping somebody from returning to incarceration.
And Monica, in that piece we mentioned, you're reporting, I think, in Baltimore, you followed an ex-inmate named Travis as he searched for a job. What kind of roadblocks was he running into?
You know, he was putting in a lot of applications in different places around the city, and it was Baltimore. And he was just never getting callbacks. And when he did find jobs, he was having trouble in them for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is that he wasn't used to working in a kind of environment where you have a manager and you have to do everything that person says, even if it's unfair. And you have to sort of adjust to performing to expectations that he didn't even know. You know, he didn't know the rules of a minimum wage job very much. So he ran into a lot of problems just even getting his foot in the door in places. And then on the few occasions that he actually got a job, he ran into problems actually being at the workplace in challenges that he didn't expect there. So it wasn't just I followed Travis in this story, but I spoke to a lot of other people, and his experiences were very common.
And Wendell, what kind of help can you provide for someone who's been in prison, maybe doesn't have that experience with how to act on a job, how to follow orders from a manager? How do you help someone make that adjustment?
Well, really, it is what we do is work with individuals on a one-on-one basis. So to be able to walk an individual through that reentry process, help them fill out applications, help them write up a resume, do mock interviews, have them meeting with individuals and opening up doors for employment opportunities for them to people and to organizations that we've worked with in the past who know of our clientele, know who we might be sending to them, that they are qualified individuals, and then getting feedback from those employers as well as to what the how the individual interviewed, what were some red flags that came up, so we can continue to work with them in this process. And that's exactly what it is. It's a process, and it's not something that is, unfortunately, just like was said here before, it's not something that individual can go out there and just get a job in a week. It's something that an individual has to struggle with at times, sometimes months, sometimes, we've had clients we've worked with for years who were putting in applications, doing the interviews, and just not get any looks, and then all of a sudden something happens. So it's just that process of helping them through interviewing, helping them through work aptitude, helping them through how to stick with a job and the perseverance to stick with it.
And Monica, you heard Travis and his peers talking both in organized settings and I think outside of them as well. What kind of frustrations were you hearing from them?
You know, what they really wanted to do was get a job. And so just not being able to get a job and feeling as though they were being judged in every situation that they approached to try to get a job. And also they felt that they that their efforts were never recognized. You know, that they would try to do all of these. They went through a bunch of different job training programs. They went through a bunch of different efforts to sort of improve their applications, and they sort of never felt that that was acknowledged in any kind of way or got them in a lot of places. And so one of the things they really felt was they started to get just really down about it. And I don't know that they would necessarily have labeled it as depression, but what they described to me was often, I would have considered it depression, that, you know, just being rejected routinely for something that you want to try to do and you feel like you should be able to do really can wear down your spirit. And I think that that's where you see a lot of problems where, you know, the thing that they know how to do and the thing that they are able to do well, because there's always somebody who can hook them up with doing it, is sell drugs. And so they would occasionally sell drugs to get extra money. And they didn't want to do that, and they really didn't want to go back to prison. So it was a challenge for them to be doing something that they didn't want to do.
That's interesting. Wendell, do you encounter this at Project Return, this almost depression from people who are frustrated by efforts not paying off in the short run?
Yes. Without a doubt, the vast majority of our clients are suffering from some semblance of some mental health anguish, whether it be depression or post-traumatic stress disorder or something like that. And many times it's undiagnosed, and the individual doesn't even know that they're suffering from any of the symptoms of depression or PTSD or anything else that is going on within them. That is a struggle, and quite honestly, that's the first thing that we have to address with the individuals before we can even get them referred to an employer or get them referred for a job interview, is helping them through that process and helping them to gain some confidence and start to feel a little bit good about themselves and recognize that they have some self-worth and some qualities that an employer is going to want. So many of these guys are beaten down by the system and beaten down by the community that they just don't believe that they can do anything else. And so it leads to further addictions and further criminal thinking and bouts of sometimes serious mental health issues.
Well, and Wendell, it's looking at your organization's website, it seems like one of the things you do to try to counter that is to focus on success stories of people you worked with. And I want to play an excerpt from one of those now. Sandaria Ramsey served time for selling narcotics. And then when she left prison, she entered a 12-week program with Project Return. She tells a little bit of her story here.
So my stay in prison was real hard. Missing my children, not knowing what was really going on because I couldn't get the phone calls. The children was too young at that time to write letters. It was really hard, so it's just a really big blessing to know that today I have my parenting rights back, I have my children's back, I have permanent employment, I have a home, I have a car. I'm just fully blessed to have that in my life today.
So, Wendell, how important is it to share those success stories with the wider community and with ex-inmates themselves?
It is very important. I mean, we go into institutions, into correctional institutions all the time, and always try to take with us formerly incarcerated individuals, some individuals who are being successful with their reentry, just to show individuals that, you know, this is something that can be attained. This is not... an unreachable goal. We also do that into the faith communities and into the community-based organizations in the greater Milwaukee area here to just show people that what an individual is looking for, what an individual is wanting with their lives, and that this is another human being, that this is a person who has fallen on some hard times and needs a little bit of help and needs to be able to get to that next level. And when you start to see the humanity and all the stereotypes of a formerly incarcerated individual start to melt away, then you start to recognize that there are 20, 21, 22,000 people just like this individual who are sitting in our institutions in the state of Wisconsin and many, many more throughout the United States here, and that every single one of them have worth and have an ability and have something that can be beneficial to society.
And Monica, did Travis and the other people in the Baltimore area you talked to, the other ex-inmates, did they see that kind of success story, or were they in effect blazing a trail in uncharted territory?
they did. The Center for Urban Families, which is where I centered part of this story, has been operating for 15 years. And so there were people who have done really well there and continue to come back and are really evangelists for the center, because it's a job training program that is different from a lot of the other things you might see. And it's in the city of Baltimore. It's 4 weeks long. People come from 9 to 5 every day, and they really work at it. And so it feels like a program that is life-changing. And so by the end of the 4 weeks, people really felt like they've done something, and it's done a lot to restore their self-esteem. And then there are also people that they meet who have gotten jobs and have been successful after the program, and so they continue those relationships.
We're talking about the difficult transition from prison to work with Monica Potts of the American Prospect. She's written about this, and Wendell Ruschka of Project Return in Milwaukee.
And you can join the conversation. Have you or someone else close to you been in this position? How hard was it to find work after prison? Are you an employer, and have you employed former inmates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about the difficult transition from prison to work and the obstacles ex-inmates face as they try to return to the job market, and their success stories as well. Our guests are Wendell Ruschka of Project Return in Milwaukee and Monica Potts with American Prospect.
And you can join the conversation. How does this affect your community? Have you or someone close to you made that transition from prison back to life outside of prison? How hard is it to find work? What kind of help did you get or did you wish you have? And if you're an employer or a social service worker, a parole officer, we'd like to hear your thoughts as well. The number to call is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. Both of you, Wendell and Monica, worked in communities where there's not a lot of employment. Monica, were there just not a lot of jobs for inmate ex-inmates or non-ex-inmates alike? And how much more difficult did that make it, Monica?
That's right. I mean, a lot of people went through this really intense job training program, and they were really ready to work. But at the end of it, there was still a jobs problem, not just for these individuals. But when you look at sort of the data over the years of when people who leave prison do best in the job market, it's when the labor market is really tight and when everybody else is working too. And so when employers can lay people off because there are just more people willing to work than there are jobs to work with them, then these people are they're the last hired and the first fired. And so they really suffer the most in an economic downturn like the one that we're still sort of in. So, they wanted full-time jobs and they were ready and they got certificates and they got their GEDs. But at the end of it, there just weren't a lot of jobs to get.
Wendell, is that, I imagine, a challenge in Milwaukee as well?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Exactly what Monica was saying there, too. You've got individuals who are returning from incarceration, taking vocational programs while they've been incarcerated, returning with certifications in welding or a different trade or vocational pattern, and unfortunately still not viewed as by some of the employers in the Milwaukee area as job ready, even though they've gone through these vocational programs. And the majority of people returning from incarceration want to work, want to support themselves, want to support their families, and when things don't become readily apparent, as has been stated before, they find other means.
I want to go to our callers now. We've got Jason on the line in Stevens Point. Jason, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your story?
I'm going to be 41 years old, but when I was 19, I committed some crimes. I was locked up. I got 3 felonies. And today, being at 41, almost 41, I have a successful career. I have a diploma outside of the system, and I didn't have any of that when I got out. I just I put my head down and worked real hard and got my foot in the door at places and proved myself right there. So it's never, ever stood in my way.
Did you get help from someone, do you think? Was there somebody who motivated you or got you that first connection or just hard work and good luck?
I had people in the community helping me out and giving me chances. Not every time did it all work out perfectly. I still made mistakes. But where I'm at today, it's a totally different story. I'm an executive chef. I'm responsible for employees, budgets, money, the whole nine yards. And I'm a three-time felon.
Jason, Jason, thanks a lot for your call. Congratulations and good luck to you. Wendell, I mean, we've heard how tough it is, but are stories like that common?
Well, they do happen, and I mean, really, it's at where the individual is. I applaud Jason for his willingness and his ability to put what he did in the past behind him and recognize that he's not those things, that he is got value, and that he is going to be somebody in the world, and he's been fruitful and prospered on that.
I want to get back
too
to
often. Too often what happens is we do have individuals who come out who don't feel like they have any worth and have such a lack of confidence and such a lack of self-worth and believe all the negative stereotypes out there so that they can't function, they can't get to that next step. And those are individuals really that are benefited the most in a program like Project Return or some of our partner organizations around Milwaukee and throughout the nation, because they just need that individual that cheerleader, that advocate, that person that's going to hold them accountable, that keeps them moving, motivated, keeps them going on. Jason, it sounds like he's an individual that was a self-starter and had that on his own, which is great.
Jason, thanks for the call. Let's go to Drew now in Prairie du Chien. Drew, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm actually an employer, and you know, to be honest with you, I have two former inmates that work for me right now, and they are probably a couple of my best employees. And, you know, just as a message to any possible employers out there, I hesitate to let somebody's past, you know, determine whether or not I'm going to hire them. It's with any other hire, you go with your gut. And a lot of times, you know, I'll get an inmate that will come for an interview and, you know, they're very forthcoming about what happened and what they've done while they were incarcerated to make changes in their life. And if somebody has that kind of determination when they're going through something like that, as if there wouldn't be enough stresses being an inmate in a correctional facility, the folks that are really trying, you can see it. And I have not been disappointed with hiring a former inmate.
Interesting, Drew. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Monica, in the training programs you saw, does it seem like there are a lot of employers like Drew willing to hear that story and give somebody a chance?
Yeah, and I think it really helps when there's a liaison like the centers that we're talking about today and like the one in Milwaukee who can sort of put employers next to somebody with a record so that they can see their humanity. You know, and I think that I spoke to somebody who is an employer in Baltimore, and he told me that the first time he met with a candidate from the program, he hired him right away because he told me he could just see the hunger in his eyes. And he just knew that he would do a good job. And he's employed about a dozen people over the course of the years because he's just found that it's a really great opportunity for people, and they know it, and so they turn into some of his best employees.
Drew, thanks a lot for calling. Now we've got Tony on the line in Shawano. Tony, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a former inmate. I'm a recovering alcoholic, throughout my 20s, I was in and out of jail 7-8 times, and finally ended up in prison. I had two felonies and was convicted both times. And when I got out of prison after serving 3 years and then I got out of prison on a bracelet in 1991. I had a bracelet on my leg for 10 months while I was awaiting my next parole hearing. And when I got to this little town in northeast Wisconsin, I decided that I wanted to try to break into the construction industry. So I looked in the phone book. There were 35 contractors, and so I sent them all a cover letter and basically an application letter. And with, you know, I didn't have any experience, you know, but it was spring of the year. I thought I had a good chance. And the company that I really wanted to work for, who was a very successful company here in Shawano, I was one of the three people that got back to me. Now, in my cover letter, I didn't mention that I was in prison. And so he got back to me, and I had an interview. Well, I was accompanied to the interview by a prison guard wearing handcuffs. and the guy took one look at me and started laughing. He thought somebody was playing a joke.
Oh,
on
no.
Him. What is this? And he said, do you really expect me to hire you? And I said, well, I think you would be happy if you did. And so I didn't hear from him. You know, he said, thanks for coming in. I didn't hear from him. 3 days later, I wrote a letter. So I imagine he got it in about 5 days. And I told him that I was very interested in working for his company. And there were two other people who were interested in having me. But I preferred to work for his company. And I didn't hear from him. So then I called him maybe 1 week later. And I called him. And he finally said, he asked me if I knew how to roof. And, you know, I thought, how hard can roofing be? So I said, yeah. and so he let me, he put me on, he let me roof his house. And then he was evaluating me and everything. I don't know, I guess. And when I got done roofing his house, he told me that I could go join the crew.
All right. Well, I want to leave it there, Tony, because we don't have much time left. Great story, and congratulations on getting the job. Wendell, I think I want to give you the last word on this. Apart from what a job means to the inmates themselves and maybe their families, how important is it for a community that these ex-inmates find employment?
Well, it's very important. You have... If an individual returning from incarceration finds employment, they are significantly less likely to recede back through the prison system, less likely to cost us taxpayers money, and more likely to actually be generating income and paying taxes on their own. They also then reconnect with family members, either by paying child support or actually physically reconnecting with family members, stay in the community for a longer time, and are an example to the younger generation of things that an individual might have done wrong, but that isn't something that defines that individual for the rest of their lives.
We'll leave it there. Wendell, thank you so much for joining us. And Monica, thank you for being with us today as well. That was Wendell Ruska with Project Return Milwaukee and Monica Potts with The American Prospect. We've got a link to Monica's recent article and the Project Return website on the Central Time Facebook page.